Defeat of the Assyrians, a historical bridge in the book of Isaiah. Hello, this is Doug Clark. Welcome to Probe. This week's Probe broadcast provides for us a bridge between two major sections in the book of Isaiah, and in the process, tells an amazing story about faith in the palace. Good King Hezekiah and his life and times teach us some lessons, and we're here to learn them and talk about them today. To help us do so, I have again asked Drs. Alden Thompson and Stravko Stefanovic, both of whom teach Old Testament at Walla Walla College, to be my guests. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Might be helpful, Alden, as we begin thinking about these chapters, because they do form a unit, and they are narrative. I mean, there's some poetry within them, but they do form a unit. Have we seen this before? Have we seen this material anywhere else?
Well, this is one of the marvelous places in the Old Testament where we have the same story told in three different books, three different authors. This same story, the story of Sennacherib and his attack against Jerusalem, and how Hezekiah and Isaiah stood firm, is found in 2 Kings 18 to 20 and also in 2 Chronicles 32. So you got three versions, and they're not exactly alike. Each one is different.
Now, the Kings one is in many ways verbally very close to the Isaiah passage. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think I've seen some parallels even in the original language. The Chronicles may be more expansive, but it seems to me that the others are pretty close in the language in any case. Is that ringing a bell?
Yes, but the judgments on Hezekiah are really quite different than where you read them.
Right.
And one, Hezekiah comes out feeling very insecure, and the other one, he comes out really quite well.
Yeah. Okay. Stravko, these chapters aren't just accidentally plopped in here. There's a purpose here. We've thought in the past about some of the passages we've discussed on Probe about what precedes. What precedes chapters 36 through 39?
Well, we have a judgment against the nations and also promises to God's people. And we certainly have some eschatological and apocalyptic dimensions. The stars of the heavens are mentioned in chapter 34. The day of the Lord's vengeance is there. And then chapter 35 containing several promises, and also calling the people to be strong in verse 4. Do not fear, your God is coming. He is mighty to save. And the chapter closes with that very famous verse. We remember some songs that were inspired by it. The ransomed of the Lord will return. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. That's how chapter 35 ends. And then we begin reading chapter 36, another crisis, deep crisis.
Jerusalem under threat. That's under right. Siege.
Now, before you leave that too quickly, I'd like to point out something intriguing about this marvelous promise, and you've read part of it here. And it reminds me of what we read back in chapter 11. Now, we didn't spend a lot of time with that, but the wolf shall live with the lamb. In other words, all the animals are vegetarians. But what's intriguing, it just shows you how the Bible writers will take a particular idea, and one will shape it one way. Because back in Isaiah 11, the little child shall lead them, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. So you've tamed the lion. Here in chapter 35, you've banished him completely, because it says in verse 9, no lion shall be there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The point is the same. There'll be no dangerous animals there, but one simply dumps the lion completely, and the other one turns him into a nice little pussycat.
Mm-hmm.
Two different ways of accomplishing the same goal.
And maybe we should kind of keep that whole idea in mind, because we now have Jerusalem under siege, under threat, but God's going to take care of that danger, too. I mean, we can take care of lions. We should be able to take care of the...
Will you allow me to help Isaiah on this point? I believe that chapter 11 describes the land to which the exiles return, primarily. And here, it's the highway. On the way back home, there will be no lion attacking people. Am I right on this one? Because we are talking of a highway... It will be called Way of Holiness. No unclean people on it. No lion, no danger of a lion. But once they actually get back home, then the lions will be tamed.
Now, in neither place does it really quite happen that way in antiquity, but...
Yes. Now, that's an interesting point, Stravko. So all the lions have fled from the highway and have gone home to Jerusalem to become tame little pussycats.
We'll pull this all together somehow. That's good. These chapters are so intriguing, and they carry this, the context from chapter 35, they carry this sense that there's danger again. We've experienced a siege under an Assyrian king by the name of Sennacherib. Sennacherib plays a significant role in Judah at the end of the 8th century with a major siege. Some people would argue that there are two sieges, but in any case, there is a siege being spoken of here in which there is a major threat to Jerusalem. Now, we have texts from Sennacherib, and one of those texts, which is recorded on the Taylor Prism, which I had the chance to see last fall in the British Museum. It's a great thing to see, knowing the history and what it says. But in that passage, in Sennacherib's own words, that as for Hezekiah the Jew, I penned him up like a bird in a cage in Jerusalem. Now, he doesn't go on to say that I destroyed the city, and the reason for that, we think, is further along in these chapters where an angel of the Lord came along and kind of sent the camp packing. So, in any case, we do have that text. We also have another archaeological note, if you'll allow me one more word of archaeology. Hezekiah, in preparation for this assault, built a tunnel to get water inside the city of Jerusalem. Actually, if we identify it to the upper pool. Now, there are debates about that, but in any case. You can walk through that tunnel, and there was an inscription found, chiseled out in not in the last century, but in the century before, and actually it's now in Istanbul, but it talks about the excitement of the diggers, of the rock masons trying to find their way toward each other because they came from two directions. And that's an archaeological artifact tied to this section of chapters too. So there's a lot that comes that feeds this, and it's nice to hear Sennacherib's actual words. There's one more. Oh, there is one more archaeological note. I'll make this one quick. But Lachish, the city of Lachish, is mentioned because that's where Sennacherib is at the time he sends his agent to Jerusalem. And we have reliefs. We have stone reliefs of that destruction, and it was brutal. You see what happens to people who don't like the Assyrians and what the Assyrians do to them. So,
you know, there's another interesting little sidelight here. The biblical account indicates that an angel of the Lord came and struck down 185,000. Now, that's interesting from two accounts. The first one, the Hebrew struggles a bit to know how to say that. And the way I have it here in my New Revised Standard Version in chapter 37, verse 36, and when morning dawned, they were all dead bodies. The translators try to get away from this idea that when they woke up in the morning, they discovered they were all dead. Now, the other point that's intriguing here, C.S. Lewis comments on this, because those who have a hard time with the miraculous can't figure out how in the world, you know, 185,000, and I don't want to go into the particular numbers here, but I like the way C.S. Lewis compares this with the story of Herodotus, because Herodotus, he says, tells the same story, also about the massive number of deaths. But Herodotus' explanation is that a host of mice came into the camp and chewed up all their bowstrings, see. And that's why the army was destroyed. And as C.S. Lewis said, any reasonable person would be on the side of the angels. Because that makes much more sense than just having the mice. But in both accounts, you have this catastrophic loss, catastrophic destruction.
There may be another way to think about it, too. And that is that the number, which really is problematic, because the Assyrians themselves, who exaggerated the number of in their army, the largest one we have in their records is 120,000. Maybe what we have here is, and the average army was about 50 to 60, maybe what we have here is just a mistranslation. Maybe it's 5,000 180 rather than 185,000. Siegfried Horn, one of our mentors, has talked about this possibility. Now, if that's true, and if you have an army of 50,000 and you lose a tenth of them, that is decimation. And in ancient times, that was a sign from the gods to pack it up and go home. So maybe that would have had a significance that we can't quite access easily because we're not part of ancient warfare.
Well, even in our day, and of course our society is much more high-strung, you might say. But you think of the incredible impact of 9/11. It was just one city, you know, and just 3,000, that's not very many. Just a couple of towers, you know, there are many more than that. But the catastrophic impact of that. So when you lose a tithe, 10% of your army, even back then, this is a sign of deep trouble.
Isn't there a propaganda war here in 36 with the languages?
Oh, yes, that's a fun piece, too.
Stravko, you love Aramaic, the language of Syria. Tell us about what's going on here. This is truly a wonderful unfolding of some dialogue.
For many centuries in the first millennium B.C., the Aramaic language was a recognized language of international diplomacy and commerce. So that is the language that the Assyrians would have used. However, here they use a translator, and the speech is made in Hebrew so that commoners can understand it.
Everybody on the city wall.
Yes, and the leaders from Judah, they plead, and they say, please don't speak to the people in Hebrew. Speak to them in Aramaic. But the Assyrians refuse to do that because, once again, the propaganda of the Assyrians here is to help their military force.
In fact, they not only kept on speaking Hebrew, they shouted louder and got nastier.
Well, and add to that the fact that we have returned to something we've talked about previously, and that is arrogance. You think you can get away from the Assyrian and the Assyrian gods. No, you know, you can depend on your god all you want to, but, you know, you're going to do it in vain. So
there's another key aspect here, because this is Hezekiah. And Hezekiah is a bit of a problematic figure, because when the Lord announced that his time for the end had come, Hezekiah didn't like that idea, and he bargained with the Lord and got 15 more years. The later history shows that that probably wasn't a very clever thing for him to do.
Depending on how one thinks about the offspring thereafter.
Yes, but you have this intriguing, tantalizing section here between the old part of Isaiah and the new part, which is to come, with this man Isaiah and Hezekiah standing together, standing firm. But even then, there are small chinks, at least in the king's armor.
We have prayers, a couple of prayers. We don't have a lot of time to talk about them. What do we have in this section by way of prayer?
Well, one of the prayers is Hezekiah's prayer after he was healed. And it doesn't appear in any of the other parallel accounts, but in chapter 38, verse 9.
Now, is that a Thanksgiving song? Is that how we would think of that as a form?
Probably. He says, in the noontide of my days I must depart, consigned to the gates of Sheol for the rest of my years. Then it comes out in a positive way.
Yeah. In the end, stories like these have lots to teach us about faith and anticipation, about confidence and cockiness, about prayer and presumption, about how people and God interact in surprising ways. Thank you again, Alden and Stravko, for your assistance today. Next week on Probe, both of you will join me again as guests. We'll continue talking about the book of Isaiah, this time the remarkably optimistic joy of chapter 4. My thanks to Steve Cochran, the producer of Probe, and to all of you for listening. With Probe, I'm Doug Clark.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you may call 509-527-2194 or email probe@wwc.edu. Join us again next week at the same time for Probe.